You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, January 27th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How's everyone doing?
Good.
We're recording a little early because we're going to be traveling this weekend. We have our first big extravaganza weekend. When this show goes up, we'll be in the middle of a four-show weekend. Three extravaganzas, one private recording, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Woo!
Yeah.
Bring it on.
It's going to be
tiring. Can't wait.
It'll be fun.
Bring it on.
It'll be fun. So we talked last week about the Chinese coronavirus that is taking off. And we said this is a fast-moving story. And sure, like by the time the show came out, and of course now the next time we're recording, things have moved significantly. So the numbers are still increasing geometrically. There's as we're recording this, again, these numbers will be way different by the time you listen to the show. We're approaching 3,000 confirmed cases, and the death rate is up to, 70? Something in the 70s?
80, I heard.
Now 80. I mean, just last time, even today, the numbers are going up. And then there's 5 confirmed cases in the U.S., although there's 100 people that are being tested that are under suspicion. So that number is almost certain to grow, although some have been excluded already. 20 countries have confirmed cases. So this is an epidemic. It's increasing geometrically. Some of the experts, like these are CDC, WHO experts, viral experts, are saying, yes, there are 3,000 confirmed cases, but that probably means there's 100,000 actual cases out there. Even as many, the estimates are anywhere from 30 to 200,000 now, So,
Steve, are they finding that the death rates are higher among children and elderly people?
Elderly people, yeah. So far, not a lot. Hasn't infected a lot of children. Children have not been hit. Actually, the number of infections are highest in middle-aged. But the death rate is highest in the elderly, although there was at least one confirmed case of a death in an otherwise healthy young male.
And they're flu-like symptoms, yeah?
It's pneumonia.
It's like pneumonia.
It's a viral pneumonia. Yeah. So the other one other bit of information. So the a Chinese official said that there is confirmed cases of spread prior to symptoms manifesting, but the CDC said no, that hasn't been confirmed, so they pulled that back. So that's something to keep an eye on. So remember from last week we said that this is a coronavirus. It's most similar to SARS and MERS. Although I think there's a Kara, you
we've been chatting.
You had an ambiguous statement, but there's four other coronaviruses that are infectious, but they just cause the common cold.
And they cause a small percentage. Most of the common cold is rhinovirus. But coronavirus can cause the common cold.
Yeah,
but the other ones
rhinovirus is 80% of the common cold. And then, everything else is 20%. But the coronavirus is number two, but it's after 80%, which is rhinovirus.
Small.
But the three severe ones are SARS, MERS, and this new one, not to be confused with MARS.
Wuhan, are they calling it Wuhan coronavirus?
Yeah, Wuhan coronavirus. It's kind of the official name right now. I don't know if it's got an official name, but that's sort of the unofficial name.
I think it's novel coronavirus and then some numbers and letters.
Right.
Are you guys watching Pandemic on Netflix?
Not yet, no.
It's really good timing because I think it actually went to air before.
Yeah.
Before the Wuhan coronavirus started to get in the news. Obviously, I think there's, with the music and stuff, it's a little bit ooh. But really, it is about epidemiology and special pathogens. And they actually play down viruses like Ebola, although they do cover them, and really play up the flu and rapidly mutating flu viruses. They show basically how quickly flu spreads, how infectious flu is, how many people really do die from the flu. It's a very pro-vaccination, right? They shine a big light on anti-vax and how it's causing a bad effect. Far it's been, I'm into the third episode and it's been really, really good. But as this coronavirus thing is happening, it's opening my eyes to just how quickly things that are highly infectious, like respiratory infectious, as opposed to something that's bloodborne like Ebola, just how quickly these things can cross.
Yeah.
And they compare a lot to 1918, right? They talk a lot about the Spanish flu and about how quickly it spread. And remember, that was before airplanes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
No, sure absolutely.
Was. And it wasn't airborne, right? I mean, mm-hmm. this wasn't at that. You get the combination of, you know, airplanes and airborne. Wow, that's bad.
Yeah.
So keep pandemic.
Keep an eye on when how they resolve the question of whether or not it could be spread prior to symptoms, because that is huge. Mm-hmm. If anyone who has played Plague Inc., that's how you infect the world. You know, you got to keep your symptoms low and your infectivity high until it spreads to a certain degree, and then of course you make it deadly. If you're just, you're trying to kill off the planet, but that's
your goal.
If that, well, in the game, that's your goal, right? So so it's funny to play with those variables and see how it affects how deadly an epidemic mm-hmm. and a pandemic is. And that's a huge deal. Some experts are also warning, again, this is early days. It's just we're right in the middle of the explosion of this, this epidemic. So there's going to be a lot of speculation about like how bad can it get. Some people think it's too late. It's going to become a pandemic. It's the genie's out of the bottle. Others are warning that it's possible that this may become an endemic infection now, that this is not just going to be one epidemic, but in fact, it's going to be just continuously in circulation mm-hmm. in the human population, like the flu, right? It's just going to be another virus that's
And it may
out
already
there.
Be endemic to in animals, right? Because that's the case with a lot of influenzas.
Could be,
well.
Yeah. They're definitely a reservoir.
Yeah.
Corona tends to jump to, the new ones, the new coronavirus tends to come from animals. But the other thing is, like, throughout the outbreak and the epidemic, the virus is mutating and evolving and could become more virulent in the course of this epidemic. Yeah. So again, it's like you keep an eye on it, you hope for the best, but you plan for the worst.
What about, like, I don't know, what would you even call it? Like the idea of being careful when something like this is going on, you know, life hygiene, whatever, but.
Yeah, just prevention, like wash your hands a lot.
Should you travel? Should you not?
So
travel?
America.
You can't travel to China.
America has issued their level of warning is reconsider your travel to China. They're not mm-hmm. banning it. They're not saying don't go. They're saying you should think about it before you go.
But you can't go to Wuhan, right?
I think, well, Wuhan, they shut themselves down. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they're locked down.
A lot of that area is locked down now.
Yeah.
Biggest quarantine ever.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So I have a question that, Steve, a medical question that I was thinking about today that I hope that you can answer that has less to do with specifically this special pathogen, the new coronavirus, but has to do with flu and how virulent flu is, especially during flu season with travel and things like that. So if, like me, you are busy and a little bit absent-minded sometimes and you forget whether or not you got your flu shot earlier in the season, is it dangerous to get a second flu shot? Because every time I try to Google this question, it all comes down to people saying, if I get two flu shots, will I be more protected? And I'm like, no, that's not what I'm asking. I just want to know if it's bad to get a second one if you already got it.
No, it's like getting a booster shot.
Okay.
There's no downside to it, just maybe unnecessary. But it's not going to hurt
you.
Yeah,
but the upside is that now you're protected in case if you weren't before.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, but how could you not remember if you got your flu shot?
Because I get it every year and it just becomes so routine that it's hard.
Where do you get it? It's not documented?
I usually go to the same place, but because I've been moving so much, I can't remember which pharmacy I probably would have been at. Because I moved within the last year. I know. It's so frustrating.
It's a unique problem you got there.
Yeah. So I called the pharmacy right by my house to see if I got it. And they were like, the only one we have on record is from the 2018-2019 season. And I was like, okay, I'm going to come in and get one anyway. So I kind of already made that decision. Yeah. But I just wanted to make sure first that it's not contraindicated to do that. And I don't know. Maybe some other people listening have had this problem. Maybe. Not just me.
Please. And how late is too late?
Never.
You know, I mean, if it's February or March and you never got it, should you still go in and get it?
Probably.
What's the cutoff?
There isn't really a cutoff. I mean, it's just you missed most of the flu season, so the benefit is less, but.
But not really, because you obviously weren't sick, so, you know, in hindsight. But is there a chance that if a flu mutates pretty badly through the season that they actually iterate the vaccine that year?
No, it's too late.
Gotcha.
They don't have time to do it. They're just stuck.
Right. So either way, I'm like, if it's a 50% effectiveness year, you're just still at 50% if you take it in.
Yeah.
In March. Okay, but it's still better than nothing, like, especially if you travel.
Better than
lot.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Right.
Very important.
Okay, here's a few details from the CDC. So if you're going to get a second flu vaccine, you should wait at least 4 weeks before doses. So if you forgot earlier in the season, you can get it later in the season. If you got it really late one season, you can get it really early the next, as long as there's 4 weeks in between. They say you should vaccinate all the way through the spring, even through May. However, if you're traveling, get the vaccine at any time if you haven't had that season's vaccine yet.
To me, other than when I had norovirus, where I was literally like peeing out of my butt. Yeah, exactly. Come, yeah.
God, that is horrible.
But it is exactly the definition of what happens in norovirus. Other than norovirus, I think that the flu is the closest I've ever felt like I was dying, like I was scared that I was dying.
And people do die of the flu.
A lot of people die of the flu.
Tens of thousands.
It's no joke.
Nope.
One last thing is that every case, this is again as of Monday when we're recording this, every case in countries outside of China were imported from China. There are no cases as of this recording of person-to-person transfer outside of China.
Well, that's good.
So
that's encouraging for the rest of the planet.
Yeah, they're trying to keep it, you know, locked down in China, though I'm reading very pessimistic projections about
right how well
it's just these things just get out of control so fast. All right, let's go on with the shoe. Kara, you're going to give us a what's the word. You haven't given us one in a while.
Nope.
I know, it's been a while. So I was digging, you know, through the list of words that we've done in the past. Where do we want to go with this? And I came out, I found an email from Dustin from New Hampshire, who said a bunch of very nice things. 2-year anniversary as a listener, SGU patron, and happy to say fully converted skeptic. Go Dustin. Thank you for writing. So he said, as a fledgling SciComer, I focus much energy educating myself on space-related matters, blah, blah, blah. A while back, I discovered the term ablation and ablated material when talking about comets, especially in regards to their tail end. Since I've seen it used in regards to planets losing material as well. And then in a recent episode, Steve used the term in reference to destroying brain tissue. So what's the deal with the word ablation? I'm always excited when a word works in both cosmic and biological contexts. It's because the core of that word, you know, means the same thing for both. So here's an interesting thing. When I looked up ablation, you know, to get the dictionary definition first, from Oxford, there are two main definitions. The first one is the surgical removal of body tissue. So that would have been the use that Steve was making. And then the second one is the removal of snow and ice by melting or evaporation, typically from a glacier or iceberg. And then within that definition, there's the erosion of rock, typically by wind, or the loss of surface material from a spacecraft or meteorite through evaporation or melting caused by friction with the atmosphere. So these are very like specific use cases, right? Surgical removal of body tissue, removal of snow and ice, removal of rock by erosion, removal of material from a spacecraft or meteorite. Then when you look at Merriam-Webster, I think it starts to come into focus a little bit more because they only give one definition, which is removing or destroying, especially by cutting, abrading, or evaporating. And so once you understand that it's like to ablate something is to remove it or to destroy it, then you can start to see how it makes sense in all of these different specific contexts. So if you're ablating something in neurosurgery, you might be removing something or just like cutting something so that it's no longer connected. But I hadn't ever heard of it in terms of like iceberg ablation or even rock erosion. You might say that rock was ablated. I never would have even thought of using it. And I hadn't heard the cosmic context either. Had you heard, because I know, Bob, you read a lot of space news. Had you heard people refer to comet ablation, like the actual loss of material from the comet?
Not often. I don't see it in print, but that's one of the first things that I thought of how to use it. But yeah, I don't see that often.
Yeah.
Maybe the more technical.
Yeah, probably the most common space reference is the ablative surface on capsules re-entering the atmosphere.
Yeah, on spacecraft, right? So if something is going to hit like high temperatures, like it's going to have to deal with high temperatures because of the friction of re-entry, they're going to use materials that are meant to burn off at a specified rate.
Yeah.
And so that's what they're referring to when they talk about ablation of like these kinds of surfaces. And apparently also when I started digging on Wiki, I found that people refer to fireproofing products also as ablative in nature because they do something similar. Some types of fireproofing are just barriers, but many types of fireproofing are chemicals that are meant to burn up very, very slowly. so that they're protecting whatever's beneath them. And that's really similar to the spacecraft design there. So yeah, the word has Latin roots, similar to most of the words. It's like Greek or Latin. And it has all these different, very specific utilizations, but they all come down to that same core definition. So I feel like if you understand the definition of ablate, then it makes sense as you start to relate it to all of these other places. And I could see you utilizing it even in other fields of science as well, so long as you're talking about similar processes.
Now, Kara, do you know what oblation means?
I looked it up because I was like, maybe there's a mix up there, but oblation is like ecclesiastical, right? It's like gifts to the gods or something.
Exactly, an offering to God or a presentation to God. But I that caught my eye because of the Golden Compass, you know, his Dark Materials, which is now on HBO. The General Oblation Board, you guys remember that? The Gobblers?
Interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I don't.
They were, you know, cutting away the demons from the children. That was the General Oblation Board.
Wow.
Interesting.
Kara, have you heard of confabulation?
I've heard of
Have you heard of a standing oblation?
Standing oblation?
I love it.
All right. Speaking of dark materials, actually, that's an unintended segue.
Ooh.
Bob, I know you made this prediction about dark matter may fall out of scientific favor in 2020.
Yes.
I don't think this is how it's going to happen, but I read an interesting article about maybe we don't need dark matter to explain the movement of stuff in the universe. Perhaps information itself has mass. Have you guys ever heard that notion? Information has mass. And the mass of the information in the universe may be the missing mass, you know, gravity in the universe.
Confused.
Wow. You can measure the mass of information?
No, you can't. But
cool.
Okay.
But let's back up a little bit. That would be a way of testing this hypothesis.
Yes.
Well, right.
It would.
But we can't do it now. So, all right. How do we know that, quote unquote, dark matter exists? You guys remember how far back this goes? What was that guy, that astronomer's name?
100 years?
Was it Rubinstein or something?
No. You're confusing two people. So it was Zwicky, Fritz Zwicky. Remember that? Fritz Zwicky.
Yeah.
He observed that the movement of the galaxies in the Coma Cluster were too fast. And those galaxies, by his calculations, if you calculate the gravity based on what you could see and the velocity of the galaxies, they should be flying apart, but they're not. So he's like, huh, that's not right. But they didn't really have a way of testing it at that point in time. It kind of sat on the back burner until so that was in 1933. Then in 1968, remember what comes next?
That was the year I was born.
1968, Vera Rubin.
Oh, hey. Yeah. That's all right. That's what I was thinking of.
Rubenstein. Yeah, so she observed, Vera Rubin observing the Andromeda Galaxy was mapping out the velocity curve, the rotation curve, meaning if you graph out how fast stars are moving in relation to how far they are from the galaxy's center, right? Mm-hmm. Now, just like with the solar system, the farther out you go, the slower the planets are going in their orbit. That's Kepler's laws. So same thing in a galaxy, the farther you get out from the galactic center, the slower the stars should be moving. There's obviously, unlike with a solar system where most of the mass is at the center in a sun, in a galaxy, as you go farther out, there are more stars within your orbit. And so the rotation curve is not the same as it would be for a solar system, but still, the stars should be moving more slowly as you get farther out. However, Vera Rubin found the rotation curve for Andromeda was flat, stars were going at the same velocity regardless of distance.
Kind of like a record spinning.
Yeah.
Right, or yeah, the rotation of
you measure the point of the groove on a record, right? Yeah.
So what that meant was, in order to explain that, there would have to be six times or thereabouts as much mass in that galaxy as we can see. And so that gave rise to this notion of dark matter, right? So therefore, there must be matter we can't see, dark matter, in the Andromeda Galaxy.
Good name.
And that observation has been verified pretty much no matter where we look around the universe. There is more gravitational effect than can be accounted for in the visible matter.
And it's not, just the the rotation curves anymore. I mean, you could look at other things like gravitational lensing that's caused by something that you can't see. It's got it's got to be dark matter. There's something there bending light with mass.
So one of the hypotheses to explain this was MOND, modified Newtonian dynamics. Maybe just like Einstein had to, he had to come up with general relativity as a tweak to Newtonian gravity to explain like the movement of Mercury, that maybe on galactic scales, gravity behaves differently than it does on the scale of a solar system. And you have to modify, the gravitational equations. And if you did that, then that could account for this apparent missing mass. But that theory has not done well. Although there is one, there's just one thing that that defenders of MOND, even the holdouts today, hang on to say, dark matter just doesn't cut it as an explanation for our observations. We need something like MOND. Because then I'll get back to the observation of Andromeda. So does anything stand out to you that's curious about Vera Rubin's observations and her explanation of dark matter?
What do you mean?
Anything stick out about
it? So there's something that's always bothered me about that. And it was kind of like, okay, that's weird, but I have to at some point explore that further just because I'm probably missing something. And so,
is it about the mass? Would more mass reproduce that behavior?
Remember what I said: the rotation curve was flat. So that would mean that not only is there dark matter, there happens to be exactly as much dark matter as is necessary to flatten that curve.
What's
the probability that that's the case? Right? Doesn't that bother you? Coincidences bother me because then I think that it's not a coincidence. We're missing a deeper law of physics there.
Well, not that I have any information that could say that this is a legitimate idea, but maybe if there's more of one than the other, they balance out somehow.
Somehow, that's the thing. That what's the somehow is an unknown explanation.
Another angle: how many curves do we have from other galaxies?
That's a good question.
Everyone is flat.
So here,
I don't know.
So I'm about to tell you. So let me read a quote from a MOND proponent.
Amandi.
He says, in fact, there is no reason why normal and dark matter should conspire to mix in just the right way for the mass discrepancy to appear always below a fixed acceleration. This systematic, more than anything else, tells us we might be facing a failure of the law of gravity in the weak field limit rather than the effects of dark matter. So that's a more technical, convoluted way of saying what I'm saying, that no matter where we look, this effect is below some kind of a fixed acceleration, in the Andromeda leading to this flat rotation curve. But even in other contexts, there seems to be some, fixed relationship there that, would be just a massive coincidence if you explain it all on the basis of dark matter. So we're missing something.
What do they say? What do astrophysicists say about that?
Well, I don't know what the full answer to that question is. So I know the MOND proponents will say that that's the answer. And then even when you present them with pretty much confirmation that dark matter exists, they say, okay, maybe there's some dark matter that we can't see. But there's also MOND, because otherwise you can't explain this weird relationship. So what's the proof that there is at least some dark matter? What's like the single—
gravitational lensing is like, bam, in the face.
And if you had to, Bob, if you had to think of one image, one piece of evidence that
the
is
coma
like—
The bullet cluster.
Yeah. There's another one too, but the bullet cluster was the first, there's
huge
dark matter. So let me explain that really quickly. There's two galaxy clusters colliding, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You guys know what a galaxy cluster is? Basically a cluster of galaxies. So, so there's multiple galaxies.
Slow down there.
And among those galaxies is a gas of intergalactic gas and interstellar gas, right?
Jay knows that.
So when two galaxy clusters collide, the galaxies themselves are what they call collisionless. they just pass right through each other.
Yeah, stars right? don't hit.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like when two galaxies pass through each other, the stars don't hit, but you know, of course, the gravitational
gravity just makes everything.
Yeah, the gravitation, you know, gravity mixes everything up. But
the gas hits.
But the gas has pressure, so the gas is not collisionless. Imagine these two galaxy clusters colliding head on. Mm-hmm. The galaxies pass right through each other, and the gas crashes in the middle and slows down. So if you took a picture of it, you would see gas piled up in the middle and then galaxies on either side having already passed through each other. Does that make sense?
Wow.
Yeah.
If you use, Bob, gravitational lensing, right,
yeah.
to image where most of the gravity is, guess where it is? It's
kept
not
going.
With the gas.
It kept going.
It kept going like the galaxies did. So, and there's more gravity than can be accounted for by the galaxies themselves. So there seems to be something else collisionless that just passed right through them each other that is where most of the gravity is. And that's dark matter, right? So that's pretty much your home run out of the park evidence for this isn't Mond, right? This isn't just modified gravitation. There's something was happening there. You know, the gas stopped, but the dark matter kept going, and you could see that by the gravitational lensing. And there's been further observations of similar situations.
So Mond is no longer required for explanations of anything at this point?
So basically this was the death of Mond, right?
The death Mond.
Yeah, except for those who say that, well, okay, there's dark matter, but we still need Mond to explain the degree of gravitational lensing. But I think that's a minority opinion and maybe even a shrinking minority opinion. Okay, so here we are living in a world with dark matter. It makes up of, you know, so there's normal baryonic matter, like the stuff we're made out of, and then dark matter is like 5 to 6 times that in terms of stuff in the universe.
Wait, it's called baryonic matter?
Baryonic baryons. Matter. Yeah.
Oh.
Baryons. So it's not like a tweak. It's not like, oh, there's an extra 5%, you know, residue of stuff we can't see. It's 6 times the stuff we can't see. It's huge.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. But we don't know what it is. We know it's not baryonic, right? Because it doesn't behave like it, like the collisionless bit, right? And from other lines of evidence, we know it's not baryonic matter. But what is it? Right. We don't know. We don't know. It's one of the big unanswered questions in physics. You know, there's still those niggling points about, like, the whole, why is the rotation curve for Andromeda flat as opposed to any other shape? That's still like, that's weird. You know, so we're missing something. There's some other relationship going on there that we don't know about, and we still don't know what it is. We don't know what dark matter is. Okay, so recently a physicist proposed another solution. Said maybe there isn't some other kind of matter out there. Maybe information itself has mass, and that's the missing mass that we think there is out there in the universe. So this, however, is not a new idea. When I searched on, does information have mass, I found stuff from like 10 years ago, you know?
Yeah.
And older. This is an old idea, actually. Now, here's where I get way above my pay grade on this, right? This is like whenever you wade into quantum mechanics, we can only sort of understand metaphors that are approximations.
Just wet our toes a bit.
Yeah, of what the actual mathematicians and physicists are talking about. So we have to go back a little bit to information theory. And the father of information theory, anybody know who this is? This will be a good forgotten superhero.
Yeah, it was like a Shannon?
Shannon. Yep, Shannon. Exactly. It's Elwood Shannon, considered the father of information theory and the digital age. This guy worked out how to transmit information over wires, you know, over
Wi-Fi. He needs to be known
Wi-Fi.
More widely.
What's he done for me lately?
He actually coined the term bit to refer to a unit of information.
Yeah.
Now, the big problem is, and when I read all the discussions I could find on it, does information have mass, and even in just the comments of my own blog post when I blogged about it, the big thing sort of hovering in the middle of this is that a lot of people don't understand what we mean or what is meant by information.
That's,
in various contexts.
That's it. That's the crux of this, I think.
That's
what do you mean by information? You got to define that precisely. Otherwise, a lot of this is like blah, blah.
And in fact, if you define information thermodynamically, right, it follows the laws of thermodynamics. So information isn't just an abstract concept. It is a physical thing that follows the laws of thermodynamics and entropy, right? Remember, you know, Stephen Hawking talking about information being destroyed around black holes, all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. It's a thing that we have to think about mathematically and physically. So this is the context in which they're talking about, does that kind of information, the thermodynamic kind of information, have mass? And one of the lines of logic they refer to is that, you know, if you erase information, it releases heat. And there's a certain, you could come up with a mathematical relationship of how much heat is released based on how much information you destroy or erase. But is that just a physical property of erasing the information, or is it something about the information itself? And again, what kind of information are you talking about?
And that's the key distinction, I think, especially if you look at what Bill Dembski has been saying about this. It's like, you could look at information as a mathematical entity, or you could look at it as represented in matter. And he thinks that Vopsin was like behind this idea. He thinks he's confusing those two. So that's what Bill Dembski is saying.
Steve, can I ask a question at this point? So, like, you know, I read the article about this, and saying that information has mass, isn't that implying that the information has to be stored in some type of substrate, you know, some type of mechanism of storage, which means that it needs matter in order for it to exist?
Sort of. You know, again, you're talking more the classical information, but in the more thermodynamic concept of information, it's a thing unto itself. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but one of the ways they discuss testing this, Jay, is to take a hard drive and, you know, empty it out. And then weigh it. Just weigh it, and then add a bit, add a byte, add whatever, a megabyte, whatever.
Or fill it. Put gigabytes on it and weigh it again. Does it weigh more?
And then
more?
Weigh it again. We would need a LIGO level of sensitivity, though, that we are not there yet to measure.
Oh, we can't
to measure that.
It.
Yeah, maybe a century before we could measure it.
That doesn't make sense to me because, like, as an example, a pencil has graphite in it that we would use to write information down on a piece of paper, right?
Yeah.
So if you weigh the pencil before you use it,
you're thinking of the wrong kind of information. So you're totally off on the wrong approach. That's a lot of people go there and in the comments they're like, yeah, what about this? You know, but you're just talking about just physically recording, you know, symbols and abstractions. But we're talking about information as a thermodynamic principle. It's like quantum mechanics. It's like, what does it mean that it's a probability wave? How is probability a thing? But these probability waves interact with each other like real physical waves, like water waves, you know? How is that possible? How is probability a thing? It's the same thing. Information is a thing,
function,
like probability is a thing.
So we don't have a means to measure it, but there are saying that there's enough information out there that collectively it could have enough mass collectively to account for all the missing mass in the universe?
Well, that's the hypothesis. I don't think that that's been demonstrated, and I don't think that the math adds up. So that's a lot. So the criticism of this is, like, first of all, this is nothing new. This is like Dr. Melvin Vopsin is the new article that I'm talking about, where he's talking about not only does information have mass, but there might be a mass energy information equivalency. So not only does E equals MC squared, but E equals MC squared equals some information, you know, mathematical equation. And that's an old idea too. That's an idea that's been floating around for a long time. So, and that something like that may be true. You might be able to tie those things together, in terms of like thermodynamics and mass energy equivalency. But does that translate to like a new source of physical mass in the universe? You know, right now, I think the consensus is no, but it's kind of just an out there, interesting hypothesis that we can't even test theoretically because we don't have the technology to do it anytime soon. You know, it's really a thought experiment at
thought
this
experiment,
point.
Yeah.
In theoretical physics that is out there. And I thought, you know, first of all, I like to review, like, the whole idea of dark matter and what's the evidence that it actually exists. You know, it's inferential, but it's pretty solid in my opinion. I don't really think that this is even a necessary hypothesis, but it is interesting, and it breaks our classical brains, right? It's like, again, the best analogy I can come up with is thinking about probability behaving as a physical wave. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't, you can't wrap your head around that. You can't think in quantum mechanics in the same way that it's hard to think about information in this way. And you just have to get rid of any classical notion you have about information. Don't confuse those two things, because that's the typical mistake, is to think about thermodynamics and entropy, right? As if it were, as if it were like a pencil, you know, writing in
I can see some huckster coming along, taking this, running with it, and turning it into some sort of, you know, Chopra-esque kind of idea. And they'll get, you know, make a ton of money on it, basically.
They already do. They already do talk about information as being, you know, ageless, and the universe is information, and therefore we're information and we'll never die. You know, that's the whole, that is Chopra. They do that already.
Great.
But in some senses, that's true.
I know. So there's definitely something there. Yeah. There's definitely something there. But
if you can package it as something you can sell someone, they'll buy it.
No, but I'm saying, like, in a philosophical sense, that's true. Whether you can weigh it or not doesn't really have any bearing. Like, if you produce memes, right, like in the classical sense of the term, or what did Karl Popper call it? It's like this layer of existence beyond our physical existence, because it's like that we create ideas, and then those ideas are written down, and then those ideas continue even after we die. So this, in that sense, information is ethereal.
You can't un-idea something.
That's also not the same kind of information that we're talking about again.
But that's what Chopra.
This is more like, this is like, yeah, exactly. But this is more like the Stephen Hawking's kind of information. Is that in Destroyed in Black Holes? Does it leave the universe? Can it leave the universe? What does that actually mean?
Yeah, or is it like smeared on the inside of a black hole? Like
residue.
Yeah.
Wipe your finger around the edges.
Wasn't that like a big Brian Greene thing when he talks about the holographic universe, right?
Is
that
the holographic universe.
We're a 3D representation based on a two-dimensional, you know, two-dimensional information. It's hard to wrap your head around.
It really is. I'm always like, what, information smeared on the inside of a black hole?
I find that harder to wrap my head around than quantum mechanics, to be honest with you.
String theory gets real weird real fast.
I think the experts who actually understand it haven't found the right metaphors to make non-experts like us understand it.
I don't know, Steve, you could have a two-dimensional plate that's a hologram that you look at. It looks three-dimensional, but it's really, that's just...
I'm talking about this whole idea of information being a physical property of the universe.
It follows
thermodynamics. Kind of confusing.
I find that more confusing than quantum mechanics.
Well, and I almost wish it's hard when you use similar terminology, like we said, and then you have to operationally define it, which is important because then we're all working from the same operational definition. But it's hard when that terminology is so laden with other ideas.
Yeah, if you don't get your terms straight, you're screwed.
I'm still waiting for somebody who actually understands this, who's a good science communicator, to explain it to me. You know, like, if anybody out there knows of that reference, that resource, let us know. If it's an article, a book, or somebody we can interview, I'd love to, like, really sit with somebody who understands this inside and out and force them to wrap my head around it. Because I think that's still a hole that I have to fill.
Yeah.
But this specific topic, Steve, or quantum mechanics and specifically?
Well, both. But yes, the
But these
both.
Aspects, but, right?
Read some Sean Carroll, bro.
But I'm talking more about the information end of it. Because I have read Sean Carroll. I have read people who do explain the quantum mechanics and metaphors that I can wrap my head around. But not so much the information theory.
Well, maybe maybe we could see if Sean wants to come on the show to specifically talk about this, because he's probably read these papers, right? He's probably at least able to translate them.
Yeah, we
them
can reach out to him.
Us. Yeah.
Well, wait till I finish his latest book first.
we'll reach out to him, but if anyone knows of any other recommendations, let us know, because this is definitely something that we need to do. All right, Bob, tell me about this thing now. They're fighting fat by injecting salt and ice. How does that work? What's going on here?
Basically, yeah, this is from a Harvard study. They tested an injection that, as Steve said, cue drumroll, melts fat. And this tickled me. I was just like kind of really into this. So this is developed by researchers from Harvard and Massachusetts General Hospital, published in the journal Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery. And it's not the mythical fat pill. It's an injection of an icy saline solution and directly into subcutaneous fat. So the solution itself is nothing magical in here. We're talking just saline and glycerol and 20 to 40% small ice particles. That's it. It's kind of like an anti-fat slushy. And you could put it in any part of the body, basically, at any depth that a needle or catheter can get to. And there is apparently no negative effects on tissues that could surround it, like muscle. They tested it on pigs. This has been tested and shown to work in pigs. They monitored for over 8 weeks during and after these injections using ultrasound and photography. and a histological and gross tissue responses. Now, histological just means microscopic anatomy. They're just using microscopes, looking at the fine, super fine structures. Gross means that it's gross. I mean, you're talking about the innards of pigs, so it's gross. but not gross to everybody. Gross here just means visible to the naked eye, whatever you could see. You don't need microscopes, just what you can see. The bottom line from that, from these 8 weeks, that eight-week study was that after a few weeks, there's a slow loss of fat thickness, 55%.
Whoa.
More than half of the thickness of the fat where the injection is disappeared. No adverse side effects, no scarring or damage to tissues near the fat. And, I mean, the fat cells are basically dying. I mean, they die and they kind of get flushed away by the lymphatic system, I believe. Garabayan, who's the lead author of the study, said, "The appeal of this technique is that it's easy and convenient to do. With this new technique, the doctor can do a simple injection that takes just less than a minute. The patient could go home, and then the fat gradually disappears." Now, this is an evolution of another process that you probably heard of. In general, we're talking about a process called cryolipolysis. And the old version that you still see on that's super popular is, and I know you've heard of it, is Cool Sculpting, right? You've seen the billboard ads. You've heard, seen ads on TV, Cool Sculpting. Now, I looked into that process. I just saw on a billboard a few days ago this big thing about Cool Sculpting. And my knee-jerk reaction, of course, is, oh, that's got to be probably bullshit, right? It's got to be pure pseudoscience. Well, it's really not. It's not pure pseudoscience. This does kind of work. And now this Cool Sculpting uses a different device. It's no injection. It's a vacuum-like device that essentially conducts the heat away from the fat through the skin, across the skin. So I'm not sure how it – apparently the skin's not impacted, but it freezes the fat cells, freezes them to death. And then after that happens – there's a period where they need to massage it for a little while to kind of like break up these chunks of like fat ice, I guess. Now, the Cool Sculpting is not as effective apparently as this new injection because the procedure is much longer. It's 45 to 60 minutes instead of really just a simple injection. It takes longer to work, up to 6 months. The fat loss itself is smaller. It's about maybe 20%, which isn't horrible. But it could take multiple – it probably takes multiple sessions. One session is probably not going to do much. You need at least two. And the vacuum can't reach deep layers of fat. So it's really – Cool Sculpting is really sculpting. It's not – you're not going to lose a lot of fat. If they took all the fat that Cool Sculpting freezes and gets flushed away and you added it up, it's not going to be a lot. It's not going to be 10 pounds of fat. It's basically for hitting areas that are very hard – there's a lot of fat cells there. When you have a lot of fat cells, even if they get a little bit bigger, that's a lot of fat cells getting a little bit bigger, and it's really noticeable. And most everybody has spots like that in their body that they want to just nuke. Also, though, Cool Sculpting has there are side effects. I read some reports of about 1% of people having negative side effects. Some people, they've got like a hard lump of fat that doesn't go away. I mean, it's like this weird little deformity. Something happens. Something goes wrong. Like the people, for whatever reason, these certain people, 1% of the people can't tolerate Cool Sculpting. And you have to have liposuction to get it removed. It's like not good. It's kind of a little scary, but it's, you know, it's not very common, but it seems common enough to me.
But if that doesn't happen, does it work?
It does. It's not cheap. I mean, I priced it out $600 to $800. I think it might be per session for Cool Sculpting. Now, of course, this injection is still being tested, so I have no idea what it's going to cost or any of that. But the Cool Sculpting itself costs money and takes multiple sessions. But from what I could tell, there is definitely an effect here. Hmm. So if you compare both of them, it's like I said, it's mostly aesthetic. There's no real overall effect for Cool Sculpting on overall lipid levels or liver function. It's not like, oh, I'm going to be healthier now. It's like that's really not the point here. And like I said, there's very little absolute weight loss. Now, the researchers were saying that the injection method may be similar to that in that not having, you know, not really affecting your health at all. But I don't know. If first off, you're removing more fat cells are dying, and you could go all over your body, deep tissue, like really deep under the skin. Now, I'm not talking about like viscera fat. I mean, I'm not talking about fat that's around your organs. You probably don't want to mess with that. That's the dangerous stuff. That's the stuff that, that causes, you know, the fat to circulate throughout your system. And that's why men, so men have android fat, which is the fat that's in the big belly. And that's why they have, there's a
Dunlap
higher risk
disease.
That's why they have a higher risk of heart disease, because all that fat is circulating in their system. So you're not really – but I mean, if you could get rid of a lot of fat using this new injection method, maybe there could be some more benefits than purely aesthetic. But I don't know about that, and the researchers don't seem to think so. So take their word, not mine. Is that when you lose weight and go on a diet, you know, because of a diet, you're shrinking fat cells. This is taking them out. They're never coming back. That doesn't mean that you can't get fat again. Sure you can, because that just means the remaining fat cells are just getting bigger. So some people who have CoolSculpting come back and they you know, they gained weight and you can't even see any difference because they actually gained some weight. But
you can make new fat cells, right?
There's only certain periods of your life when you actually create fat cells. Very early in life, and then during adolescence, there's a handful of times where it's created, and that's why it's very important not to be overweight during those periods of time, because then you're stuck with those fat cells. That's it for life, unless you have some sort of surgery like liposuction or this method of freezing them. This is a cool technology. This injection, Harvard's involved in this. They did the tests on pigs. Looks pretty promising at the least.
Kind of skinny.
Yeah, skinny pigs. So this is cool tech. I'll be watching this for sure. Hopefully, it's not too expensive.
So, Bob, when they melt the fat, where does it go?
Well, they said to them, "How do you get rid of stuff that enters your lymphatic system?" I think probably just piss it out.
Do they poop it out?
Poop, piss. You know, one of those exits.
But then where does the poop go?
Ah, nice.
Away from
you're segwaying. Segway. Segway alert.
Jay, maybe
alert.
You could take that, pick it up from there.
Steve, you know, I can answer that question.
Yeah?
Yes, three I notes. Can.
So I just want to give people a heads up. Apparently, there are people out there that don't want to hear about poo or poop. They don't like to hear the words. You're going to have to fast forward because I'm going to tell people, I'm going to tell you what happens to your poop after it leaves your body.
Oh, should I have trigger warn people when I talked about peeing out of my butthole?
Trigger warning. Okay.
So what? It's poo. It's a part of all our lives.
Everybody poops.
Some more than others. I mean, legit, every single person that's ever been alive, that's alive today, has to poo.
And not just people, Jay.
Animals, yeah.
Animals.
So On average, we poop about 320 pounds or 145 kilograms each year.
Really?
Yep. And I thought it would be a lot more than that. It's got to be more for me. And once we flush it, you know, we don't think about it, right? We're not like, oh, what happened to that poop from last week? You know, we don't think about those guys.
Out of sight, out of mind. Thank goodness.
Last year, maybe, but not last week.
I mean, yeah, if you clog the toilet or you've got a leaking septic, yeah.
That reminds me of a funny story. You guys...
Oh, God, boy.
If you've had kids, so not Kara.
That we know of.
They make those the magic genies, you know, so when you're disposing of diapers.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, like you put the diaper in the top, and then you twist it, and it encloses it in plastic, right?
Yeah, so, almost like a kid's balloon. You twist it, and it makes like a little air bubble.
So it doesn't smell.
So it doesn't smell, right?
Isolation.
So it's just, you know, it's a little thing. What is it, like 2-3 feet high and... You know, a foot in diameter. Yeah.
Talk trash can size.
Yeah, it's like a trash can. It's basically a trash can for the poopy diapers, where you isolate each one by twisting the plastic around it. A colleague of my wife had one of those for their new kids and was surprised when it got filled because he actually thought that like the poopy diapers just vanished.
Presto, it's gone.
Like it was gone. Like it just.
And yeah, there's a household disintegration beam in there. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Like, what did you think was happening? Like, I don't know.
Like, what TV show?
The Extermatron 4000.
Not see back in the 70s to make that. Like, come on.
Wow, dude.
Goes to the poopiverse.
You know what that reminds me of, Steve? A friend of mine bought a house in New York State.
Yeah,
and it was you know, probably like a good 70 years old. The house, and he was doing some renovating. And there was a hole in the wall that had a razor receptacle where you could drop your used razor in like the razor head in the wall. And I'm going back to like the 20s now, right?
Yeah.
And when they opened up the wall, there was hundreds of used razors just in the sheetrock, like in between like the 2x4s and the sheetrock. And I remember thinking to myself, wait a second. Somebody at some point in the construction process had to realize that this was just going into the wall.
Sure. You know what I mean? I think that was the idea.
Yeah, but why wouldn't you put a little trash bag or like, you know.
Because they figured there was enough room in there for a lifetime of razor blades, I guess.
Okay. I don't think a lot.
They put like a warning sign. It's kind of like, you know, the whole thing about nuclear waste and we need to come up with some sort of language.
Yeah, right?
Because 30,000 years, nobody might, you know, be able to understand our signage.
Oh, yeah. Wow, we are three tangents removed from the original news item here. I love it.
Anybody that's used a diaper genie knows what a poop sausage is, and that's exactly what those things are.
Nice.
All right, so
but Jay, your poop does actually go somewhere.
If you live in a major city, if you have a house and you have a septic field, it goes out into the fields in the house, right? So you have a receptacle tank, and what happens is. This is like the mini version of what I'm about to describe. But, you know, the liquids are on top, the solids go to the bottom, and then the liquids just go out into the leaching fields. And the leaching fields distribute the effluent. And the effluent, actually, a lot of people think it evaporates. You know, if you have a leaching field in your backyard and all of that material, like most of the water evaporates. It's not true. It goes right back down into the water table. The ground filters that water, that effluent water.
Wait, but is that effluent treated?
No, it's not. It doesn't need to be because the ground itself is doing this process.
The ground takes the bacteria and stuff.
Yeah, there's also bacteria. There's bacteria.
But how does your backyard not smell like a giant sewer?
It does.
Well, it can.
Oh, it can. If your soil is not deep enough, right? If your leaching fields are not, I think they need to be below a foot and a half of soil.
Yeah.
If you have erosion over time, you know, the grass will keep growing. Yeah, then what will happen is you'll get a spot where the effluent comes up and then it can smell. But if the soil's deep enough, you won't smell it and it works fine. The system works great. Yeah. So
the grass does grow greener over the septic tank.
Sure.
Absolutely. There's more nutrients.
Absolutely.
Like lush, dark grass. That's where the septic tank is because it's getting all the nutrients.
But if you're literally just peeing and pooping and then it's being leached into the ground, like – Isn't the soil and the water table going to be filled with all sorts of antibiotics?
You don't put the well next to your septic tank.
Right.
No, but you said it eventually makes its way into the water table regardless.
Yeah, but then it's treated by the ground, you know.
Yeah.
The ground takes
does the ground
the
actually
stuff.
Remove like medicine?
Well, that's Kara,
that's a good question.
The answer to that in a lot of cases is no. There are medications that get into the ground soil. But
Who's flushing medication into their septic system?
Yeah.
No, Evan, like I'm on birth control. So when I pee, there's birth control in my pee.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know what I mean? That's what I'm talking about. Or people who take antibiotics. Yes, don't flush your drugs. Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
don't flush drugs.
Ever.
Bring them to the pharmacy.
Don't ever do that. But there are some drugs that we're pissing out into, like just because they're not fully metabolized.
Right. Yeah. Right. I get that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Jay, you're talking about wells and septic tanks. So you're not talking about city. Poop.
Well, he's moving on to that, right?
I'm moving on to that, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so let me tell you. Now, the more industrial version of this process, which
well,
is...
Well, Jay, when do the poop fairies get involved?
That's a very tricky question, Steve, and it does depend on what language you speak. We don't have time to get into that. So this is what happens if you live in a city.
Mm-hmm.
The wastewater, everything, the sink, the... everything in the shower, the toilets, and then also city street runoff that goes into the drains there, that all goes down into the septic, you know, the sewage water treatment system that a city has to have in place. So what happens is the solids will end up sinking to the bottom of whatever the first tank it is that this particular city is using, right? So they have a series of tanks. The first one, the liquids are going to be on top. The solids go down to the bottom. And then the liquids end up immediately getting pushed off to a processing plant. Now, once it's a liquid, the same process is going to happen that I'm about to explain to you. This process really is everything, including the solids, getting turned into liquid, right? There are some solids that are left over, and I'll also tell you about what happens to that. But when I tell you in, you know, step one here that liquids are running off, they're going to be treated in this process. So first what happens is the solids go to the bottom and they turn into what's called sludge. And sludge is a technical term that, you know, waste solids are called sludge. The second stage in this process is called the activated sludge process. So poop is loaded with microorganisms, right? And mm-hmm. they're eating up phosphorus and nitrogen that's found there. And you could consider this a serious cleaning phase of the sludge. So for example, the microorganisms that they're eating the nitrogen and phosphorus, they're consuming it, they're metabolizing it. And if that wasn't happening, if those microorganisms were killed, let's say they were irradiated and you were just testing, like what would happen if the microorganisms weren't here? You would have a massive algae growth that would completely block up the waterways. You know, the big pipes that they're using to move this stuff out of the city. You would also end up with very dangerous compounds like ammonia that would end up developing from the phosphorus and the nitrates that are present, right? So the next step in the sludge process, this next tank is called a digester. And what happens is there's a different environment in this second tank. What they do is they have the temperature elevated up to about 95 degrees or 35 degrees Celsius. And the oxygen content is deliberately made to be lower, as low as possible. And this gives anaerobic bacteria a chance to take over. Now, this kind of bacteria does much better in low oxygen for obvious reasons. And at this point, the anaerobic bacteria break down what's left of the sludge into water, methane, carbon dioxide, and some facilities that do this can recapture those gases and use them for fuel. They actually would use them for this process. So it's kind of feeding its own, you know, they use the gases to feed the heat that they need in order to achieve the temperatures that they need to do this process. So the good news is, that's right.
Yeah.
So the good news at this stage is that any pathogens that are present in the sludge get killed in this process. You like pretty much all of them do. I'm sure that there are cases when they don't, but this is where they die. So now in the last step, what they're trying to do is they're trying to extract all of the liquid that they can out of the sludge because it's still got a ton of liquid left into it. Mm-hmm. So what they use is a huge centrifuge. I mean, think about it. They put it in this thing. They spin it up. All the liquids come out eventually.
Separator.
Yeah. And then
the dried out sludge now has been turned into something called biosolids. And mm-hmm. believe it or not, 55% of these biosolids are used for agriculture.
Yeah, fertilizer, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
So approximately 1% of farmland located in the United States uses biosolids as fertilizer. And the reason behind this number being as low, like you're like, why only 1%? It's because farms need to use so much fertilizer that there aren't actually enough biosolids to use it, because there's nothing wrong with these biosolids. They're a fantastic fertilizer. They're wonderful. They have everything, almost everything that your typical farmland would need to reconstitute it. But there's just not enough of it because, you know, even with all the people that live in the cities, there just isn't enough, because a farmland, if you think about it, the expanse of farmland across all of the arable property and land that's out there, we just don't make enough of it. So 17% of biosolids end up in an incinerator. They just turn them to ash. And a portion of that is used to produce energy. And everything that's left over goes right into landfills. So the original 320 pounds or 145 kilograms of poop that you do every year, 47 pounds or 21 kilograms of biosolids will be produced from your load from that year.
And the rest is just... Mm. Garbage.
Yeah, it goes, yeah. Well, the biosolids could go into landfills, but now they're not putting sewage into landfills. They're putting biosolids.
Yeah.
And again, it's just fertilizer at that point, because this process, the microorganisms that do the things that they do during this multi-step process, strip away all of the bad stuff out of it, you know, and then the pathogens will get killed in the anaerobic phase. You know, this is what happens in rivers and you know, in ground soil and all that. This is happening all over the planet all the time.
Yeah, but the problem is that in all of those different ecological systems, there's oxygenation, and in landfills, there isn't. So you just end up with like these like dense, thick areas of garbage and also apparently human feces. I was not aware of that, but nothing has air reaching it.
I thought they put in piping systems for airflow.
I think they try.
And gas
I think they try to get
things.
It as good as they can so it doesn't catch on fire.
Yeah, they can do it now, Kara.
But it does happen.
The science behind it now is actually very good.
Better,
I mean,
yeah.
I've been around. There was remember, guys, in New Milford, there was a huge a dump that they did a really, really poor job of piping and capturing the gases and everything. And it ended up creating like a 5-mile zone around the dump that was, it just smelled awful.
And I think the thing is, unfortunately, that's common still.
Yeah.
That landfills are very stinky and they're also, like, fires start there.
Yeah. But that isn't really, you know, you can't blame biosolids for that. And it's not, the biosolids are not feces. They're feces and biosolids are two very different things. You know, when you go through this process, you know, it's all being stripped away. So, you know, as a side note, as an example, I happen to know someone, my niece is dating someone who deals with turning, you know, food byproduct and everything back into fertilizer. Mm. And I also saw a wonderful documentary about what happens to all the leftover food from Las Vegas, because Las Vegas is like an unbelievable producer of uneaten food. So, you know, literally, like, the guy was like walking past this giant, gigantic looking worm shaped thing that they just, you know, they just dump all the food there. And he's like, look, there's like whole hot dogs in there. You could just look in there and see like uneaten meals. And, you know, they spray certain things on there and bacteria. They keep it very damp. They cover it, you know, and then they come back and, you know, a number of months later and they take the tarp off and it is unbelievably awesome topsoil.
Yeah.
You know?
Compost.
It turns into compost. So, you know, as gross as it is, you know, human waste is...
It's part of the system, man.
It is part of the system. And you have to just kind of, you know, respect the fact that the earth evolved and humanity and mammals and all creatures evolved to, like, you know, for it to be handled.
Yeah.
But it does require, like you said, that processing.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people don't...
Yeah, you can't have raw sewage just kind of floating around on...
No, you can't. It's hoping it all works out. It's very dangerous from a public health perspective. Because I think some people think that you can just take, like, the litter in your cat's litter box or the poop in your cat's litter box and just throw it in your compost heap. Like, that's not good. There's a lot of pathogens in there.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, like, it has to be processed.
Yeah, I mean, that... See, what will happen with that poop is, like, when you wet your compost heap, if it's... connected to the ground, you know, some people have the bins that they're doing it separate from the ground. But if it's connected to the ground, it's going to kind of get into that process, because when animals poop, you know, if you go camping and you poop on the ground and you bury it or whatever, like, it will go through this process.
Yeah, just you wouldn't want like a high concentration.
No,
of
definitely
untreated
not.
Poop. Yeah, because then you'll have like disease, I think.
Yep,
festering.
So there you have it, guys. That's the process, and it's, you know, we're just copying the natural process. We're using the exact process that lives in nature, and we're exploiting it and maximizing it to handle volume and all that. But it works very, very well.
So we can't really use the term away, like throw away. So poop doesn't go away; it just goes back into the system, into the cycle.
All right. Well, thanks for straightening that out, Jay.
It was a shitty news item, but somebody had to do it.
Yeah.
God.
Evan, tell me about this massive solar scam.
Well, it's only titled The Biggest Criminal Fraud Scheme in the History of the Eastern District of California. Yes, so that's technically what has happened. But the co-owners of a California solar company have pled guilty.
Ooh.
Guilty in connection with a $1 billion Ponzi scheme whose main victims included the likes of Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated, that's Warren Buffett's investment company, Progressive Insurance Corporation, we've heard of Progressive Insurance, Sherwin-Williams, if you're familiar with paint, the Sherwin-Williams Corporation, just to name a few of the big, more notable ones. But equally as big a victim was you and me and other taxpayers of the United States. So do I need to go into what a Ponzi scheme is? For the audience.
Is that different from a pyramid scheme?
Well, they're really kind of the same. So a Ponzi scheme, technically, it's an investment fraud that pays existing investors with funds collected from new investors. They lure their victims in with promises of high return investments with little or no risk. What could possibly go wrong? So they take in the new investment money and they use it to pay those who invested earlier and keep some for themselves along the process. And yes, it is sometimes referred to as a pyramid scheme. So if you envision a pyramid, at the highest tiers, those are the people who ultimately receive all the money. Those on the lower, middle and lower tiers, so the massives, like the mass amount of people involved with this, they are never able to see any returns whatsoever. And these schemes always collapse under their own weight. The criminals at the top of the scheme become rich. Everyone else loses all the money that they put in.
And this is what Bernie Madoff went to prison for.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, that's exactly right. To the tune of $65 billion was the final accounting. Yep. Deemed the greatest scheme perpetrated on people. So that's, yeah. So this one's not quite that big, but still this one was pretty impressive in its own right, and it had to deal with solar power. So I'll explain that. So the two culprits here, the Jeff Karpoff and his wife Paulette Karpoff, these are the criminals, husband and wife, team of con artists. Jeff pled guilty to federal conspiracy to commit wire fraud and money laundering, and Paulette pled guilty to money laundering and conspiracy to commit an offense against the United States. Their company business was called DC Solar. And there are others in the company or in the business who also have entered guilty pleas into their respective cases, and these are all related charges as well. Now, DC Solar, what is that? Well, DC Solar built mobile solar generators for sporting events and music festivals. Records indicate that supposedly there were over 17,000 of these mobile units in action. The company started in 2011. By the time 2018 came around, supposedly they had built 17,000 of these mobile solar units.
What's a solar generator? Is that a solar-powered generator?
Right. That's correct.
Oh, okay, cool. Yep. Gotcha.
Yep. However, only a fraction of that number was actually ever built, let alone put in service. I've read some varying estimates about how many were actually built. The most apparently could have been about 8,500 units, so that's roughly half. But in some cases, they estimate it was less than that, and probably because a lot of these never made it into service. But regardless, the number was inflationary enough to be considered fraudulent. That's the point. And the company attracted lots of investors, especially big investors. And they entered into these kind of complex deals and raised money through what are known as tax equity funds. So I'll try not to get too deep into the weeds. You'll all fall asleep and you start talking about taxes and stuff. But essentially, they're investment funds, which qualify for special tax credits and other things like special accelerated depreciation, other tax code related benefits. Okay. So you have these big companies who use these as part of the portfolios that they sell ultimately to their clients. There's a lot of potential benefit and upside to these. As Karpoff once told Inc. magazine, he was interviewed in the mid-2010s. He said, within a short time, we were doing over $60 million in sales. This is just like basically a two-person operation that started. He said, and the key was the investment tax credits. It helped create a financial model that enabled us to keep growing. So again, you got these companies investing in this. They're able to show larger profits because of the tax credits that they're entitled to for having invested in this particular technology. But it only works if you actually build what you say you're going to build. The investment money eventually fueled the Karpoffs' personal spending, as all these scams do. In the end, they owned about 148 collector cars, classic Fords, classic Bentleys, wow, among others, which all got auctioned off in order to help repay some of the people who had and companies who had losses. They owned at least 20 properties, if not more, and also a professional baseball team located in Martinez, California, north of San Francisco, a minor league team. The U.S. Attorney McGregor W. Scott basically put it like this. This billion-dollar Ponzi scheme hurt investors and took money from the United States Treasury. It represents not only the largest criminal fraud scheme in the history of this district, also represents the largest criminal forfeiture in the history of the district, $120 million in assets forfeited. All money will eventually be returned to the victims. It also targeted the United States Treasury. To date, $500 million has been returned to the Treasury. So you can start to kind of get a sense for how much money was actually ultimately taken by these people. Thank goodness they didn't spend it all. They were able to recoup a good amount of this stuff. So I think the point here, maybe, is that it's kind of shed a light on this whole issue of tax credits related to energy efficiency products or, you know, new energy products that we're trying to get companies and investors to invest in, which is a very good thing. But then you have these scammers like this who ultimately wind up undermining these kinds of systems, and it throws into question a lot of these things. And eventually you're going to have some political motivations saying, well, maybe we shouldn't be doing these kinds of things, and that will start to have an impact potentially on future investment in solar and other sorts of new renewable energies, which is something we don't want to see. We don't want to see less investment. We want more investment in these things. Well, I kind of
in the long run,
I don't know. I think though, I think accountability though, generally speaking, especially when it comes to government and the larger the bureaucracy, the harder it is kind of to keep track of this stuff. The fact that they allowed it to go kind of on as long as they did, and no one ever realized what was going on, is kind of troubling. Someone from inside the company outed them basically, and that's how they found out. It was the only way, is that someone blew the whistle basically on these two people, and that was the only way they found out. So whatever internal methods governments and these other, frankly, big companies like Berkshire Hathaway were doing, whatever security or that they need to do in order to take a look and see what's the underpinnings are of these companies, make sure that they're operating correctly and putting forth the promises and the proper investments that they're saying they're doing, it failed. Whatever those systems were for auditing and accountability absolutely failed. Now, if we someday move into kind of a carbon credit economy, in which this is going to be a huge, huge part of whatever new economy that a carbon credit system would work under, you got to have that stuff tied down. You cannot allow people to make these kinds of, you know, schemes and plots and things. There will always be attempts by con artists to take advantage of these sorts of things. And if you're not prepared, I mean, you're going to be taken to the cleaners to the tunes of tens of billions, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars, if we're talking about something as large as the future potential carbon credit economy. So I think that's kind of the takeaway here. At least that's what I get from it.
Yeah, it's definitely unfortunate. You know, it has really nothing to do with solar per se. I think it's just exploiting it because it's the latest thing. And there's a lot of solar scams out there, actually. You have to be very, very careful. Not all as big and blatant as this.
Yeah, even when I was looking into it, Steve, like looking into putting new panels, I got like a good quote and it looked pretty decent, blah, blah, blah. And then I like shopped it around and I talked to some people who actually work in the industry who were like, I don't think you're a good candidate for this. Like, honestly, I feel like you're going to be paying so much more money. You're never going to recoup and blah, blah, blah. They're just trying to sell you panels. Mm-hmm. Like at a certain point, you really do have to kind of weigh all of your options. But when the system is put in place that there's so many subsidies and that there's so much incentivization, you're right, Evan, like people are going to try and take advantage of that even when it doesn't quite make sense to do so. And that's like at the low level, like that's not even illegal, but at a higher level, like active scamming. Yeah. You think it's not really, like you said, Steve, because it's solar per se, but just because it's like new.
Yeah. And again, it could be a model again for future similar types of plans. And if we want to really start to make the big investments that we frankly need to be making into the new energy models and things, it is going to take large investments. But if you're going to tie it into credits and other things, you really got to you got to keep it tight, you know, in order to prevent this kind of fraud. But I think just kind of how they got away with this, frankly, for so long and nobody was able to figure it out from the outside is a bit scary.
All right, Jay, choose that noisy time.
Last week I played this noisy.
Wow.
What is it, guys?
I think you said you wanted a very specific answer on this.
Yes,
it's like I did. A Halloween witch, but
yeah, kind of like that. Crypt Creep is kind of what I thought of, you know, the laughing thing from
the Crypt Keeper.
The Crypt Keeper, yeah.
Well, Brian Keevan wrote in and said, "I thought of a pheasant or partridge immediately when you played this. The sound at the very beginning seems like doors opening on a cage or small box and wings beating. So I was thinking about maybe birds reared in captivity being released into the natural habitat, as it sounds like the bird moves away from the mic fairly quickly." That is incorrect, but very, very descriptive and very cool. I'm glad that that you had that little mini movie happen in your head. And you're not completely wrong, and you'll find out why. Another listener named iPuppy wrote in and said, "Jay, I actually don't think this is the sound of someone laughing. I think it's a mechanical effect, maybe a spring-loaded wheel or paddle that is wound up and released, and it makes that noise as it oscillates, maybe rubbing against something else as it slows down. Regards, Brian." Wow. iPuppy.
Weird.
That was a very good guess. Very good guess. You are not completely wrong either.
Oh, not completely wrong.
Yep. So the winner for last week, you ready for this? This was from a listener named Aaron. Aaron wrote, "Hey, Jay, this week's Who's That Noisy is a squeaky metal door being opened, bouncing off of a shelf behind it, then wobbling forward, producing that evil laughing sound."
What?
"And the noisy." Listen again.
It's a metal door that is squeaking on its hinge, but it's vibrating. The door was opened. It hit something that was behind it, and that's vibrating on its hinge, and the hinge makes that squeak.
Oh, jeez. If I suddenly heard that out of context, I'd be like, whoa, what is going on?
So everybody kind of – I got a lot of guesses like this. These were the best ones about – like, what could produce that noise? Like, you know, if you think of it as not a human laugh, then what would make it, right? That's what they all got. They all realized, like, this is definitely something else. Because it does sound like a human laugh, like a Halloween effect or whatever. But I really thought that one was a lot of fun. So I want to thank Zoltry for sending that in. That was a really cool one. I have a new noisy for you guys this week. Every once in a while, I like to play a noisy that I find to be humorous. And this is one of them.
Do it.
That was sent in by a listener named Matt. Matt, thanks a lot. It was funny. It was Matt sent me this email quite a while ago, and I was trolling through my own emails. You know, I want to shake it up a little bit, see if I forgot about some fun noisies. And I see this unopened email. I open it up, and he was like, "Yeah, I'm just gonna like send this to you, and I think you'll like it. I highly doubt you'll ever use it." And I'm like, "Matt, I love it. Are you kidding me? I'm gonna use it." So that was cool. So if you think you know what it is, please be specific. And you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, by the time people are hearing this, we will have already begun most of our performances.
But you can still book the Seattle shows. We have a private show and an extravaganza in Seattle. Give them the info, Jay.
So you could come see our private show. That's going to be in Seattle on February 15th at 1 p.m. And you could also come see us do the extravaganza that same day, February 15th, at 8 p.m. All of this information that you need is at theskepticsguide.org/events.
Yeah.
And by the private show, we mean a private recording of our podcast. It was like a two-hour recording. And they're a lot of fun. Those shows are always great. We get much more off the rails. Oh, yeah. A lot of stuff that never gets into the show because it's just too extreme. So we're pretty uncensored during those recordings. They're a ton of fun. One quick email. This comes from Jessica from Washington State. Jessica writes, "I'm in a mom's running group, and it is rife with pseudoscience. They often talk about going to a chiropractor, cupping, taping, and all the other usual suspects found in fitness. This is one I hadn't seen before. This is spreading a lot of misinformation that the writer is preying on pregnant people who are already saturated with misinformation. Fitness pseudoscience is one of the areas that really gets under my skin." So what she's talking about is using kinesio tape during pregnancy. You guys remember kinesio tape?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It does literally nothing.
Very colorful.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, it's tape. It does what tape does. So this was popular, I believe, in 2012. So 2012 Olympics. You know, you saw like the multicolored tape on athletes.
Super complicated places.
Yeah. And everyone's like, what was that? Apparently, a lot of those athletes were paid a lot of money to wear the kinesio tape.
Of course they were.
Not surprised.
Yeah. But this is pretty much pure pseudoscience. Developed by a guru over 30 years, and somehow over 30 years managed not to produce any quality scientific evidence that it actually does anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's promoted using a lot of like chiropractic and acupuncture and all that kind of stuff, applied kinesiology, you know, the applied kinesiology, right? Like you hold your arm out and I can push it down if I want to or not, all that kind of nonsense. So now they're putting it on the bellies of pregnant women to support the muscles and always promote blood flow. Why does everything blood flow? That's like,
does it also reduce
blood
toxins?
Circulation? I didn't see that because it's on the outside. I guess that there you go, Kara. That's the next thing. You got to make detox kinesio tape. It sucks the toxins out.
Yeah, sucks.
Sucks the toxins out.
Why do I have a feeling that already exists?
Yeah.
It probably does.
It's when I just take any two pseudosciences and mash them together, you know, people will go for it. So, you know, like a lot of these things, it's tape. You know, if you put tape on your joints or whatever, it supports it, you know, to some extent, but it's no better than any other tape. And there have been the research, as scant as it is, doesn't really show that there's any effect there. So this is just a pure gimmicky pseudoscience that's just metastasizing to pregnancy. And Jessica is correct that pregnancy, and like, you know, Bob, Jay, and Evan, you know this, like when our wives were pregnant, the pseudoscience just comes out of the woodwork. Everybody has their favorite pseudoscience to push on that. And the fitness world also completely rife with pseudoscience. Because like anything novel you introduce, people will think subjectively works a little bit. You know, there's a massive placebo effect for anything like sports or fitness or, you know, anything like that. So not surprising at all. But thank you for the question, Jessica. Okay, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake-a-rooney. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. No theme this week. Are you guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
I think you'll find these quite interesting. Item number one. Scientists find that a species of paper wasp is able to recognize individual wasp faces, a rare talent in insects. Item number two. A new study finds that women perform better than men on visual spatial tasks, contrary to prior research. And item number three. Chemists report a process by which they can cheaply and quickly create usable graphene in bulk from any organic material, even garbage. All right.
Should be hauled away as garbage.
Who hasn't gone first in a while? I feel like, Evan, you haven't gone first in a while.
Are you sure about that, Steve?
No, I'm not. Did you go first last week?
I'll go first then. No, I didn't.
All right, go first.
Garrett went first last week. Right. Thanks, Garrett.
You're welcome.
Followed him right off the cliff. So a species of paper wasp that's able to recognize individual wasp faces. And that's considered a rare talent in insects. Okay. Why would they be able to do this? How are they able to recognize? They came up with a test of some sort that was able to confirm this. What would that be? What kind of wasp test would there be? And I don't know about that one. That one seems a little too clean in a way. The next one. New study finds that women perform better than men on visuospatial tasks, contrary to prior research. You know, I was flipping through the channels earlier tonight and came across a show called Brain Games, apparently.
Yeah.
That's on. And although I only stopped for a bit because I had to go prep my news item, among other things. And I have a feeling they were talking about spatial recognition. Is that the same thing as what we're talking about here, Steve? Visuospatial tasks, like spatial awareness?
Yeah, like any task, like the classic one is rotating an object in three dimensions and then being able to draw it from another perspective, for example.
Right. And so I wasn't able to watch the whole episode, and now I wish I had, because I probably would be able to nail this particular one. I don't know why I thought it was the opposite, but I can't rely on just a piece of something I saw on television to help me with this one. So I guess I'll have to move on. And the last one, chemist reports a process by which they can cheaply and quickly create usable graphene in bulk from any organic material, even garbage, and even you and me, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
So we can become usable graphene someday.
Ooh.
Apparently. That one seems, I think, of the three, the most plausible to me. So I'm going to go back and I'm going to concentrate a little bit more on the wasp or the women performing better than men on visuospatial tasks. Boy, I think I'll go with the visuospatial tasks one as the fiction because I think it's just the opposite. The research must have confirmed, actually, new research that this has held up, and it's not the opposite of what they had prior thought. So I'll say that one's the fiction.
Alrighty, Jay.
All right, the first one here is scientists find that a species of paper wasp is able to basically recognize his friends. So why would a wasp need to distinguish an individual? So that one is very iffy to me. The second one here, a new study finds that women perform better than men in visuospatial tasks, Yeah, you know, when you just in the very sophomoric thinking of, you know, we were cavemen and men went out and you know, and they hunted while women were gathering food and taking, you know, care of children, you know, wouldn't the men need the better sight? And so I see what Evan is saying, and I agree with him. The last one, chemists report a process by which they can cheaply and quickly create usable graphene in bulk from any organic material, even garbage. That one sounds too good to be true. And like when you say they can create graphene, like, you know, is graphene something that's so common that it's found in everything? I think I will agree with Evan, and I will say that the second one about the visio-spatial tasks thing is the fiction.
All right, Kara.
A species of paper wasp can recognize individual wasp faces. Okay, I buy it. Chemists report a process by which they can cheaply and quickly create usable graphene in bulk from any organic material. That sounds like the tall order here, from any organic material. Because I guess that means there would have to be carbon in it. That's the definition of organic material.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So if there's carbon in it, can they make graphene? Is graphene made from carbon? Is that why Bob's going last? New study finds that women perform better than men on visuospatial tasks, contrary to prior research. One study found that? Sure. A study can find anything. So, like, this is just a crapshoot for me. I'm going to... The graphene one sounds cool, and if graphene is actually made from carbon, which I think it is, there's like nanotube, there's like the carbon, or buckyballs, right? Like the little carbon balls. Shit. Steve, this is a hard one. I'll go with the cheaply, quickly processed by the chemists as the fiction, hoping that there's enough specific stuff going on there that like maybe it's cheap but not fast, or maybe it's fast but it's expensive. I don't know, because I feel like, yeah, a study could find that women are better than men at visuospatial tasks. Why not?
That's so you're picking graphene the carbon. The graphene. Okay, and yeah. What did I do? Bob.
Yeah, graphene is an allotrope of carbon. So let's see.
Thanks for that.
The wasp. Yeah, I mean, I could see it. I don't think they necessarily need to recognize a face, but it could be a side effect of pattern recognition for something else, I suppose. Let's see, the visuospatial tasks. Yeah, I just don't see that one as grabbing you enough, Steve, to mess with it. I don't think you would make that one the fiction. I'm gonna do the graphene as fiction. That's just really good. It's too good. I mean, any organic material and quickly and easily make usable graphene. What does usable mean? But I think that's a little bit too much. So I'll say that one, graphene is fiction.
All right, so you all agree with the first one, so we'll start there. Scientists find that a species of paper wasp is able to recognize individual wasp faces, a rare talent in insects. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yay.
Yay.
So why do they need to do it, Steve?
That basic claim is actually somewhat older news, like from 2011. The new research, so it still is true. Scientists did find that. That's just that basic claim is not new. But the newer research was extending that, looking at the sort of genetics of it. But that's a good question. Why would, and it's only one species of paper wasp that can do this, Polistes fuscatus. And that the question is, why do they need to do that? Probably because they live in nests with multiple queens. And so there is a much more complicated social hierarchy.
Yeah.
And the wasps have to be able to recognize like other wasps and where they fit into that hierarchy, who they're working for and what their rank is.
How low do I bow?
So it's interesting. There's on one of the articles, one of the other research, they show a picture of like 9 of these wasp faces, and they're really distinct. Like you think they all look the same, but when you look closely, it's like, wow, yeah, you could totally see how they would be easy to recognize one from. It's like a Disney show, you know, like Disney, when they have a show with animals, the animals all look distinctive so that the audience could tell who is who. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway, that's what it reminded me of.
That's what aliens say about us. Yeah, you think they look the same, but yeah, those humans look a little different. If you look closely,
yeah, they all look different, like the slightly different coloring and everything. What they did in the original study was they put like a yellow mark on some of the wasps, and then the other wasps treated them differently. Like they knew they didn't treat them like invaders because they could tell from scent that they were part of their nest, but they didn't know where they fit into the hierarchy. So they were they were all kind of trepidatious about them, but eventually they kind of figured out where they fit into the hierarchy, and then they were fine with them. Then they knew how to react to them. And so they sort of relearned what their face looked like, or they matched that face with their rank and position. That was just one of the things. But then the newer one is looking at sort of how rapidly these wasps can evolve, and then specifically the evolution of intelligence in general in insects, including in these wasps. And yeah, these wasps actually have quite a bit of intelligence. So that was cool. Let's move on to number two. A new study finds that women perform better than men on visuospatial tasks, contrary to prior research. Jay and Evan, you think this is the fiction. Bob and Kara, you think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Ah,
is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Kara, I hear what you're saying, but I usually will pick a study that I think is at least credible. You know, yes, because any throwaway study could say anything, but also it has to be wrong enough to kind of justify it. No prior research has really shown that women outperform men. It basically all shows that men outperform women.
Mm-hmm. Well, either men outperform women or they're the same.
Or they're the same. The new study showed that they were the same.
Gotcha.
But no study that I've ever seen says that women outperform men. Yeah, so I think it was not true enough that I felt that was justified as the fiction. And
which is why I was like, a study could totally
show. I hear you, but
that.
I try not to do throwaway studies, because you're right, and any throwaway study could show anything. But this is a pretty decent study. It was on college students, but you know, they did what they did in this study, here's the new bit, is that they gave the subjects a little bit longer to complete the task. And so men were a little bit faster than women. And if you didn't give them enough time, they would outperform them. But if you gave them just a little bit more time, the difference completely went away and they did the same. You know?
Interestingly, because I want to say that that's, it might not be a replication of a traditional study, but I want to say that that's at least been shown before, because as you mentioned, Evan, last week, or now it would be 2 weeks ago when this airs, the episode on men's brains versus women's brains of Brain Games actually covers that. So anybody who saw that episode who's listening to Science or Fiction might be like, hey, if you give them enough time, they tend to do the same. It's just under time pressure. Men tend to do
better. Is that really like they showed this?
Yeah, I think they specifically point that out in one of the commercial bumpers.
Maybe
it
was a pre-release or something, but this is just published today.
That's hilarious. I love that.
That's funny. Okay, all of this means that chemists report a process by which they can cheaply and quickly create usable graphene in bulk from any organic material, even garbage, is science. This is
cool. That's
awesome.
That's good.
Yeah,
cool.
Lab turns trash into valuable graphene.
About time.
Now, this isn't like pristine graphene. This is like the filler graphene that you would put in concrete, you know, or would put in blacktop. That's like that. Graphene is used as a filler for a structural.
Really?
Yeah. It's already in wide use. But it costs a lot. You know how much it costs per, let's say, per ton? What would you think graphene costs per ton?
A ton of money.
Between $67,000 and $200,000.
Yeah, that sounds expensive.
Wow. What? Yeah, what kind of filler the hell are you going to warrant that expense?
Well, yeah, that's right. It's used for higher end materials because it's expensive. But they were saying that even as little as 0.1% of this graphene in concrete could make it much stronger and replace a lot of the traditional binder, which reduce the cost and the environmental impact of concrete significantly.
I just Googled it because I'm like, I don't know. I think of a ton. That's like a meaningless number to me. So you said it's like how many thousand? Hundreds
up,
of thousands?
Up to 200,000 per ton.
Whereas a ton of concrete, just concrete on its own, is $50 to $75 per ton.
Right. So that would slightly increase the cost of it. So, but this new process, it uses a very high temperatures. This is out of Rice University, lab of chemist James Tour. It says it's a quick and cheap process called flash graphene. Flash graphene. It turns anything into graphene in a fraction of a second.
Cool.
Could be used on rubber tires, on plastic, you know, throwaway plastic. Again, banana peels, anything organic. The graphene is heated up to 3,000 degrees Kelvin, or I should say 3,000 Kelvin. There's no degrees there. 3,000 Kelvin or 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Yeah, it's cheap and fast. So, cool. You know, hey, maybe
scale it up.
Yeah, take our throwaway plastic, flash it into graphene, put it in cement, and kind of get a double environmental benefit there. They didn't give a price as to what it would cost, so I guess they would have to ramp it up to industrial production levels, and then we'd see what the cost is going to be. But they made it sound like it would be significantly cheaper.
Is it actually reducing the garbage as well?
Yeah,
that's cool. It's
sequestering a bunch of carbon.
Yeah,
sequester a whole bunch of carbon in our roads, so, in our cement. Yeah.
So important.
Yeah.
So yeah, hopefully that will pan out.
That'd be nice.
It won't be a flash in the pan.
Not funny.
And then, because there is you think there's multiple layers of benefits. They were sequestering carbon. We're using less cement. We're getting rid of garbage, getting rid of plastic. It's all good.
Win, win, win.
Yeah, triple win. Love it.
I like it.
5 years.
5 to 10 years. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Evan. Now, Evan, when you chose your quote of the week, was that based on knowledge of what my news item that I was going to talk about? Or was it a coincidence?
Is it okay if it is?
Yeah, I'm just wondering.
Because it was.
Was it a coincidence or was it by design?
No, it was specific, yes. All right. Because I was reading a blog post, a particular blog post, and the name Vera Rubin came up. So I thought, let's have a Vera Rubin quote. We haven't had one from her in a while. Here you go. Each one of you can change the world, for you are made of star stuff, and you are connected to the universe. A beautiful reminder from Vera Rubin.
Hey, did Carl Sagan borrow the term star stuff from her?
That's a good question.
Have.
Maybe.
Would
I don't know where star stuff started.
Yeah. What's the provenance of the term?
That's a good question. Maybe I'll look into that and report in a week or so.
They could have independently come up with it because it's not that complicated. But
no. Sagan is certainly well known for having used that term quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But Vera Rubin was awesome.
Yep,
spent absolutely. Her life advocating for women in science and was known for her mentorship of aspiring female astronomers. Plus, of course, all the dark matter related research she did. So we love Vera Rubin.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
She's definitely a forgotten superhero of science.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Early on.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me. And next time I see everyone together, we're going to be on the road. We're going to be literally on a road trip in a van going to do some shows.
Yeah.
A little mini tour. Right? It's going to be fun. We
might actually post a few videos along the way out to our patrons, among others.
We'll tweet out our experience. Sure, whatever.
Nice. Whatever.
We'll have our social media guy on the road trip with us.
Yeah.
So he'll do
that's the only time you actually see posts on our Insta.
Ian will be tweeting and doing Instagramming and Facebooking and whatever other noun we could turn
into. MySpacing and CompuServing. Yeah.
You'll be tick-a-tocketing.
All right, guys. Thanks again.
All right.
Yeah, brother. Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.